This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
Since 2000, Brooke Gladstone has shone a light on all different aspects of American politics and culture through the media prism as co-host and as managing editor on WNYC's On the Media. Now she's out to shatter your perception of reality. In The Trouble with Reality, a rumination on moral panic in our time, Gladstone demonstrates how for many, the election of Donald Trump was a world-shattering event, the happening of what we were told for months would never happen. Not only could many of us not perceive of why anyone would vote for Donald Trump, but Trump himself appears to exist in his own reality in which rules do not apply. Radiolab co-host Jad Abumrad calls The Trouble with Reality, quote, a spirited rampage through the Hall of Mirrors that is the new post-truth era. Gladstone will be in conversation with Margaret Sullivan, who previously served as the penultimate public editor of the New York Times before becoming the Medium columnist for the Washington Post. Now, please join me in welcoming Margaret Sullivan and Brooke Gladstone.
Well, hello, everyone. Good to see such a nice crowd here. So I'd like to get started with the kind of interview part of this just by asking you, Brooke, how you came to write this book and whether it took you a long time and what the publication process was like.
Yes, I wrote this book over the course of 25 years of the What happened is that the station, WNYC, through its agent, connected with a publisher, Workman, for us to put out a book related to the program. And after Donald Trump was elected, I mean, a couple of weeks after, Workman's publisher and the agent showed up in the office and said, we want you to write a book now, a book about the distress that people are feeling, which seems so much keener, so much sharper, so much more excruciating than ever before. And I just said, okay. The world is changing so fast, I am afraid that whatever I write now, when it comes back in, you know, 2020, or whenever you publishers get your books out, it won't make any difference anymore. And I said, I will write this in 2 weeks if you get it out in 2 months. And that is what happened. So I finished this in March. Well, wait till you read it before you applaud. But
okay, well that is extremely impressive in the world of books. Was The Trouble with Reality happening before Donald Trump became president?
Oh yeah. I mean, we've always had trouble with reality because we've never all lived in one. I mean, we all carefully handcraft our realities. We can't live without simplifying the world and making it comprehensible. And we really can't comprehend the world as it is. So like animals that have sharper senses in some areas and duller senses in others, we pick up some things, we don't pick up other things. We see the seen and the unseen, and we weave them together into a kind of a universe that makes sense to us. And that's a real shorthand for what I sort of lay out in the book. We create this problem, and we have to, because it's a necessity for being able to function. On the other hand, what happens is that when these realities are so disparate from each other, then in the great highway of infinite realities, you can have a colossal multi-reality smash-up with piles of shrapnel flying all over the place, and that's where we find ourselves now.
So, you know, what, for you, what has been a particularly worrisome moment in this recent passage?
so many to choose from. No, but the thing is that, you know, there is, you know, the, as I also lay out in this, Masha Gessen, the great reporter, I mean, the great Russian journalist who moved here years ago and has been writing just stunningly terrific, insightful things in the New York Review of Books, says that it isn't a question of the lies. It's the lying. It's the fact that Trump has been able to strike a deal with his constituents that he can basically do with reality as he likes. They know that he's lying. It just doesn't matter. And it doesn't matter because they believe everybody is lying. And they also believe that the engines of accountability don't work, that data doesn't really reflect things as it is. The press has its own agenda, is just another special interest. So suddenly, he is able to kind of assume dominion over reality itself. This is different. This is different from, say, George W. Bush, when Karl Rove said memorably to Ron Suskind in, I think it was a Sunday New York Times Magazine piece, that you and the reality-based community are just going to have to get used to the fact that we are going to be throwing realities at you. You know, we now will be the masters of reality. The difference between Trump's era and that of George W. Bush is that the Bush guys were trying to create a consistent alternate reality to a particular end, which was to convince us to go into to invade Iraq. And in fact, this happened really before almost every war that the country has ever entered. There was the creation of an alternate reality, usually by government. In the case of Trump, it's not about an alternate reality. It's about undermining the idea of reality itself. Because if we can't work from a common pool of facts, even if we derive different lessons from them, even if we have different goals, even if we, you know, we'll dispute around the edges and our missions are different and our philosophies are different, if we can't, we can at least negotiate unless we don't have any common pools of facts. And without negotiation, you can't have democracy. And that opens the door to authoritarianism. And that is part of what is so uniquely scary for us, for many of us right now.
Are you actually deeply worried about the future of our democracy? Or are you feeling like this too shall pass?
Well, it's going to pass. what passes with it, I don't know. I mean, in the end, so much of this comes down to one's personality. And, you know, I've always been someone who takes this sort of incredibly long view. Like, I wrote this comic book, History of the Media, a few years ago. And, you know, basically, it starts in at the beginning of the written word and goes to the year 2042. And I, that way...
And you look just like your caricature in that book.
But in any case, in that book, you know, you could see patterns, ebbs and flows and recurrences, and they weren't all exactly the same. You know, as the saying goes, you can never stand in the same river twice. But there are things that have happened before that are not terribly different from what is happening now. Some of those were very, very bad things that left a trail of mayhem in their wake. So I have no doubt there'll be a great deal of cleaning up to do. I know that if I want to feel more comfortable in this world, I have to understand how the world is created. And so I guess my feeling is that if I'm feeling that way, lots of other people ultimately will feel that way. And then maybe we can start to assemble some common pools of information again. I mean, call me Pollyanna.
That was very helpful. Thank you for that. Well, and so what in particular has given you hope and made you feel like things were going to be okay? You know, have there been moments, have there been news stories, have there been, you know, things that have happened?
Well, they mostly involve big things rather than small things. Like when I see most recently, the court's decision on the districting in North Carolina was huge to me, because part of the problem that I feel we have is that democracy, for a variety of reasons, the primary system, redistricting, a moribund electoral college system that hasn't worked since the second U.S. election, which is just a fact. I mean, it's just a historical fact. It was meant to do something. It stopped doing that after the second election, and because it wasn't considered democratic. So, you know, between all of those things, you know, if we could get at least our representative government more reflecting the actual majority, I think we'd be in a better position. And so that decision, which speaks to so many other decisions, really cheered me. For one thing, it shows that the court can still work. So we got that going for us, maybe, for a while. And then the other thing is, you know, the levels of engagement, you know, the sense of volunteerism that I've seen, and the people who will write their representatives, or more important, phone their representatives. You know that they don't care if you sign petitions. You have to phone them, which is a pain, but they count that. So, you know, that kind of thing makes me feel, you know, I haven't seen this kind of level of that since I was really young, and maybe not even then.
What about the press? How well or poorly do you think, it's very hard, as we know, to talk about the media. It's very broad, but I'll ask you anyway. How well do you think the news media is doing in this era?
Well, I'm just going to re-stipulate what you've already stipulated, which is that, you know, I can't speak for the hyper-partisan media out there on both sides. The Louise Benches, who thinks that everything is about Russia, or, you know, the Breitbarts or the InfoWars and whatever the hell they're saying. So it's so if we talk about the media, the institutional media, or the blogs, or the responsible people, or I don't even know how to identify it. It's, you know, people who will apply some standards to their work and whose mission is presumably to give people good information. I think that they're in a transition. They had this sort of a deal with covering the government and other things too, of, you know, sort of basic civility and understanding each other's role in this system, and that's been completely pulverized by Trump. So they would be fools to follow the same rules, and they haven't developed new ones. So people talk about how partisan the media are, and it's true that there has been a huge pile-on, and I could criticize that, but I think fundamentally that level of engagement that you feel in much of the public, you also feel in the press. I mean, Washington reporters, they're so energized. It's like they're war reporters, on to glory in the grave, you know? And, you know, I think that's good for the media. I also think that the public, and I don't think you can talk, I mean, if you're going to talk about the media, you always have to talk about the public, because they're either trying to reflect them, they don't want to get too far ahead, they don't want to get too far behind, but they still live in different worlds, and they don't always see what's going on in vast swaths of the country. But much of the public has been kick-started, so to speak, to understand that you have to pay for information. It doesn't come free. If you want quality information, then you can't rely on your, you know, on Facebook to curate look, the majority of people, now literally, the majority of people get their information from Facebook, even more than television. That's, you know, the big issue here is that there was a time when there were, you know, gatekeepers, and there were people to ensure that, you know, birthers wouldn't get into the mainstream conversation. Well, it's very democratic now, and there's much to praise about that situation. In the old days, the only people who had a say were, you know, rich white people who didn't have accents and, you know, didn't, you know, black people, people who had vowels at the end of their name, people who lived, you know, in places that didn't look so nice, a lot of what makes this country was not represented in our so-called consensus media. So I'm very glad that's gone. But with the trampling over of the gatekeepers, it means that the gates are wide open. And if you want quality information, you realize that you have to pay for it now. That's why the Times is doing much better. So is the Post, I understand, right? And public radio is doing much better, too. This will enable the media to do their job better. If people get bored of paying for it, they'll start to do their job worse again. It's a business.
What do you mean when you say there's been a huge pile on?
A pile on of what?
You said that you think that it sounded to me like you were saying you think the media...
Oh, yeah, a pile on, yeah. Well, there was an interesting Shorenstein Center study that, I didn't say the T word. I guess that was the problem. A pile on Trump is what I meant to say. And the Shorenstein Center at Harvard had a study that showed that at least since they were measuring things since Reagan, Trump has had by far the most negative coverage of any president. And so it's very easy for the Breitbarts and the Daily Callers and so on to say, here's proof positive.
Bias.
Now, the people at the Shorenstein Center say that, okay, how do we determine what is negative? Well, what is negative is whatever the person you're writing about would think is negative. So that, I mean, and you can't read Trump's mind, but you can assume that if you're fact-checking a Trump story and you're saying this is wrong and this is wrong and this is wrong, he would regard that as a negative story, and actually, why not? It is.
But it doesn't necessarily reflect bias.
No, and that's the problem, is that this talks about the kind of coverage he's getting from the press, as the Shorenstein Center indicated, but it is not a study of bias. And so, you know, but what I hear from people across the spectrum is that this pile on Trump gets a little numbing.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, we can talk about that too. I mean, I study and criticize the media a lot in my day job, so I can certainly do that now. I think there are better ways to use one's resources sometimes in the coverage of Trump, or even as a citizen.
So you have a chapter in your book called Recovering Reality, and you tell people to preserve their strength. Could you explain?
Well, yeah, this gets exactly to what I was saying. You know, the press and the public know. Everybody in the country, probably on the highest peak in Tibet, everybody knows that Trump is a liar. So we can't, have I shocked anyone here? Do I need any smelling salts? So why, we don't have to constantly show that Trump is a liar. You know, there was a time earlier on when it was really fun, like when he said, oh, this inauguration, it's going to be so big, there's no dresses left in town. And somebody from the Washington Post went, actually, there are a lot of dresses left in town. And I go, you know what? That guy's a liar. But the thing is that, you know, when I talk about preserving your strength, keeping your powder dry, even on more serious issues like Melania probably came here illegally, let's say. I haven't really studied the issue, but let's just say Melania came here illegally, and if Trump's policies were in, she would have to be deported. Ha! He's a hypocrite. Big deal? Do you like Trump's immigration policies? Because if you do, maybe you have a problem. If you don't, shut up. Are you defending them? You know, it's like, why tie yourself in knots over petty hypocrisies?
So is it a kind of pick your spots?
Pick your issues, the ones that best reflect your values, and act on those. Try to prevent the spiking of your cortisol levels by getting upset about every damn thing that's going on. You could just melt in it. So what I say is, you know, if there are some things that you think, this is what I really care about, I really care about the fact that his regulations have delayed workplace safety issues, that his regulations seem to have, either delaying or canceling, regulations, that they enable wage theft, or you care about the environment, or you care about the lack of support for data collecting agents and operations, or any of these things, focus. Just focus. You'll feel better for acting. You might actually have an impact, especially if you work your local guy. And
can't do that about every single thing.
No. And, you know, look, there's this, the whole trope of the Facebook group. You know, I hate war. I've just joined a Facebook group about it. You know, it's...
It doesn't really help.
No, it doesn't. It really doesn't. You know, it's somehow there's no cheap way to engage. It's all expensive. It's all retail. If you really are upset, channel it. Or as a friend of mine was once on a bus and he heard someone saying in front of, this is being recorded, so I can't use the F word, right? But someone in front of him said, I got two words for you. Shut the F up. You know, and that's how I kind of feel when, you know, the super stress of it all, act. You'll feel a little better. It's not going to go away. These are interesting times. We all fear for our kids, but it is what it is.
You have a section of the book in which you talk about Orwell and Huxley and draw some distinctions. Could you tell us about that, or maybe even read a little bit?
Funnily enough, I have that here marked. This comes from Neil Postman's really great book called Amusing Ourselves to Death. It's in the foreword. He distinguishes between the kind of world that was envisioned by Orwell in 1984 and Huxley in his dystopian novel, Brave New World. And what he wrote was that Orwell feared that the truth would be concealed from us. Huxley feared that the truth would be drowned in a sea of irrelevance. Orwell feared that we would become a captive culture. Huxley feared that we would become a trivial culture. In 1984, Orwell added, people are controlled by inflicting pain. In Brave New World, they are controlled by inflicting pleasure. In short, Orwell feared that what we hate will ruin us. Huxley feared that what we love will ruin us.
Pretty good stuff. Everyone should obviously run out and buy this book.
I'd written it. I did a lot of creative stealing in here.
We're going to go to questions. So there are microphones, and have at it. I think I'm going to fail.
Wow. You're leaving?
No, but I don't.
Oh. You did great. No, I mean, whatever you...
Yeah.
Okay. I'm being abandoned. Margaret Sullivan, ladies and gentlemen. The great Margaret Sullivan.
Hi. Hi. Thank you very much for coming. Thanks for your program. I love listening to On the Media.
Thank
it's amazing.
You.
I many years ago, the Reavers during the Reagan era did a concert, a reunion concert, and what they said was they were trying to reassure everybody. They said, "This too shall pass. I've had kidney stones, I know." So, and I sort of feel like there's a lot of parallels between the Reagan era and the Trump era, because Reagan really tried to manipulate the media, because he was very good at it. And I was wondering if you could comment on the similarities, but I don't know if you see them.
Reagan started evading the mainstream media really effectively. He was probably the first to sort of go above the heads of the mainstream media. This was a technique that was followed, as technology would allow, by every subsequent president, Democrat and Republican. Reagan was one of those alternate reality type people as well, you know, trees will kill you or they pollute or something like that. But, and, you know, he tried to get rid of the EPA and then had to reconstruct it and brought back Ruckelshaus to do it, right, who had initially created it under Nixon. He wasn't as disconnected from the world. I mean, to be honest with you, there have been plenty of presidents that I've feared or I've doubted, you know, or any number of things. There have been many political periods where I felt an enormous amount of stress, but I just feel that Trump is a world apart from those things, because there seems to be no way to get purchase on this guy. He is truly his own reality, and there isn't anything that happens that he can pay attention, that he'll pay attention to, unless he's at the center of it. In fact, there was a story, I think it may have been in the, was it in the Times, Fred? When someone said, you know, to get him to read to the bottom of the memo, you have to put Trump, 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 or else he'll just stop reading. You know, that's the kind of thing we're dealing with here. So I don't see, and also Reagan never condemned the press as an unnecessary institution without a mission. I honestly don't see a huge comparison between the two.
Although Reagan did try to make up things that he said that happened in movies and say they actually happened in real
life. He either did it on purpose or he was confused. We don't know. But it was, he had a doctrine.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, there isn't any doctrine. Anyway.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Could you comment on how you see on the media being positioned politically? I'm a huge fan. I subscribe to the podcast.
But
are you and Bob Garfield piling on? I mean, I don't recall many segments that are in any way supportive or defending Trump. Not that necessarily he.
No, we haven't had any. I think that if we show balance, it's that we attack the same syndromes in the left as we do in the right. No, we don't go out of our way to say, well, Trump, you know, didn't insult anyone today. You know, it's just, I mean, maybe that comes into the zone of, you know, normalizing, you know, setting a bar so low. I don't think it's our job to do that. And this week we talk about the weird conspiracy theories that infect the left, you know, and we've talked, you know, during the Obama era, we talked a lot about using the State Secrets Act to close down trials and information and, you know, trying to get leakers and his aggressiveness in that area and all sorts of things. So we've applied the same kind of metric. In other words, the things that would horrify us then would still horrify us now. But the question of how we approach it is one that Bob and I continually deal with. We had a podcast the day after the election called What Next or Now What or something like that, where you literally Bob and I are yelling at each other. We were in such a, you know, we got a lot of tweets going, I hate when mom and dad fight. the thing is Bob and I still are in sort of fundamental disagreement on certain things, and we are, you know, we continue to negotiate from a common pool of facts.
Hi. As someone who started their reporting career for a small local paper when Mr. Woodward and Mr. Bernstein were doing their job, one of the three questions, one comes out of that. Really, they were not inside reporting from the inside. They were really on the outside. So if we were to lose, one of the questions we have, you know, if we were to lose the press conference, we're, you know, just made up stuff anyway, how bad would that be? Second question would be, of all of Donald Trump's peculiarities, which one frightens you the most? And thirdly, so as a former political reporter, I've been wrong about every single thing about Donald Trump. So I want to give you that same chance. How do you see this ending? Does he, you know, impeachment, not elected again? And feel free to be wrong, because I've been wrong every time on him.
I'll answer the last one first. I was interviewed in Newsweek recently, and they asked me the same question, and they put it at the end of the interview. That's probably when he asked it. And I said, after having written this book, I really understand that I don't know my ass from a hole in the ground. So I'm not going to negotiate. I'm not going to predict. In terms of what frightens me most about Donald Trump, I would say the one thing that frightens me most encompasses so many other things, which is his utter isolation. He is so completely cut off from sources of information, from empathy, from experiences outside of being a, you know, a rich kid who got a, you know, his fortune handed to him, from being a boss whose saying goes, from you know, the freedom to redefine his own failures as successes whenever he felt like it. This kind of isolation, this disconnection from the world, is what frightens me most about this president. What was the other question?
I forgot too. So
okay.
It's not that important. You answered the second one. That's really what I wanted to hear.
Okay.
Oh, the press conferences.
The press conferences.
If they,
all right.
If they die, is that
okay.
The worst
you
thing
know,
in the world?
They're relatively recent innovation. They were started in the Clinton era. They were never supposed to be every day anyway. I mean, my feeling is that, you know, the Washington Press Corps could free up its time, actually do some reporting, and, you know, rather than get lied to every day, they can get lied to, you know, twice a month. I think that'd be great.
Thank you.
Hi. Thank you for being here. Thank you to both of you for being here, and actually mm-hmm. I intended this question to...
Margaret. Margaret, are you still here?
To include both of you, if you both... were willing to say something. So my question has to do with what I observe to be a trend in the print media, at least the parts of it that I read. And I read the New York Times and the Washington Post far more than any other print media. So the trend that I feel like I observe in the past, say, 3 or 4 months is a sort of noticeable effort to become more objective, at least in certain ways, or at least a response to the criticism that the mainstream media is biased. And I'd like to include both, you know, right of center as well as left of center in the mainstream
media. You think that they're trying to be, that you're seeing a note towards the more objective. Okay,
well,
so that is about the most opposite of what I've been hearing lately. But
okay.
But that's interesting.
Well, I mean, one example, I guess if I had to give a single example, is the recent series of articles in the Times that say, here's what we've been reading, here's some good stuff on the right, here's some good stuff on the left.
Yeah, that's a different
thing. So that's a new mm-hmm. Thing. They haven't done that before, and I take that to be a response to criticism. So anyway, it's a two-part question, and the first part of the question is, would you agree that there's been, in your opinions, any trend along these lines in the left of center mainstream media? And regardless of your answer to that, do you feel that there have been any trends just more generally in the mainstream media and especially on the right of center? They have been, what I'm observing for the Times and the Post, been reciprocated in any way or equaled in any way by the Wall Street Journal or whatever?
Some of that stuff I can't answer because I don't have a good answer, but I can respond to this here's what I'm reading thing that you're talking about. There's long been a concern about something that computer geeks call serendipity. That is to say, having encounters with information that you wouldn't normally go to. In other words, You know, you're watching, you're reading the front page of the New York Times and you see an article about Ghana, and maybe you're not that interested in Ghana, but it has a good lead, and then you read the story about Ghana, and then suddenly you're kind of interested in Ghana. That's what they call serendipity, an encounter with accidental information.
Right.
Now, as we get so nicely digitally sealed into our bubbles, if all we care about is gardening and volleyball, that's our entire life, right? So, you know, what the Times is trying to do is to puncture little holes in the bubble, just so that if you're, you know, if you're a Times reader but you never read Commentary or the National Review, and they think that there's an article that's worth reading. And the key thing about reading outside your comfort zone is you don't want to go to the most extreme stuff, because that's just validating. That's not going to challenge you at all. You go, these people are crazy. I was right to begin with. So what you want to do is you want to go enough out so that you can hear an argument that makes you nervous, because maybe they have a point. And that's that nervousness tells you that you're challenging yourself. And I think that that's what the Times, Slate is doing it, lots of websites are doing it, Google is experimenting with it. And, you know, everyone is trying to create a kind of serendipity in order to deal with that problem. It's been broiling for a long time. I'm sorry.
Well, what I would say is that during the campaign, there were a lot of complaints, particularly about the Times and the way this was expressed as in this phrase, false equivalency, right? So that there was all this crazy stuff that Trump was doing and all this insanity, and the feeling was, well, we have to even this up somehow. So the complaint, I'm expressing the complaint, was so the way it was evened up was by taking the email scandal and elevating it far beyond what it ever was so that it could be equal to, like, every day of insanity. And so, actually, I think that that sense of false equivalency is something that at least the Times is kind of trying to live down. And I you know, don't think there should actually be an effort to You know, I think what we should be trying to do is present the truth and not present both sides. I mean, obviously, we want to show a range of opinion and everything, but I think any effort to kind of even it up is fraught with problems. So I don't know. I think the wackiest thing I've seen, though, along the lines of what we're talking about, is the effort by, I think, just a columnist at the Times to say something nice about Donald Trump. I mean, you know, I don't know.
I agree. We don't need that.
And, do we have any more questions? Do you have a question?
Yeah. Uh-huh. I think you go back to that side.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, as someone who used to work with Neil Pearce, he did write a book in the 60s about the Electoral College, and there was legislation offered, and it didn't happen. Second point, I'd like to know, could you talk a little about the way the news cycle happens on a story? So, for example, leading up to this most recent event about the Paris Agreement, there was all this discussion, and I'm thinking, you know, I read the New York Times and the Washington Post, and there was all this guessing, you know, all this, well, he said this, and he said this, and he said this, and then he says it, and then afterwards, it seems to me, I've been seeing in the Times little articles and graphs that say what exactly the details were of the Paris Accord, and so, like, per capita, what it would have cost an American for all that money, and it just seems to me that I get the details of what's really in the issue at the
end of the cycle?
At the end of the cycle. As opposed to, so that I, as a person who doesn't understand what's in the accord or the issue du jour, can say, well, yeah, I really think, look at these details. Wow, well, I would think this way. And then...
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good observation. I don't know... I'm not sure what the question is, except that I do feel that there is always more attention than perhaps is warranted on the politics of the issue, and less on the substance of it. Do you want to say anything there?
I think that's absolutely right. And speaking of the Shorenstein Center at Harvard, which just keeps coming out with these brilliant studies.
it just went off here. Oh. Okay.
The Shorenstein Center looked at the coverage during the campaign, and it showed that it was very, very oriented toward the horse race and not at all oriented toward substance and toward issues. And while we all want to say, that is terrible, that should never happen, the truth is that those are the things that everyone wants to read. Everyone wants to read the horse race, and so it's kind of like saying, I love broccoli, but, you know, you really would prefer to have the hot fudge sundae. I mean, how do I know that? I mean, there have been studies done about what, and we look every day at traffic on stories. So the metrics are very easy.
You can know a lot better now than you ever could before.
Yeah, the metrics are very easy to come by.
Where do people click? Where do they share?
Yeah.
How long do they stay on that story?
But I'm not saying that's a good thing, but it is something that has been happening more and more, and it is a problem.
Okay.
I just want to say, as a woman of color and a descendant of people who were enslaved and who's well steeped in the history of slavery in this country and what happened during Reconstruction that came out of it, for some of my people, we did believe that he could win because we fully, fully feel and understood the hatred in this country. And if you listen carefully, it didn't start yesterday. You know, it started some time ago. But even then, the media existed, not in the way it did now. And you see, you know, parallels in terms of what was covered. But what I want to ask you is, where is the resistance? What are the people in the Congress, the Senate, and stuff doing? From my perspective, we've been here before. Nobody died and made 45 God. Now, where's the resistance from the other people? They have media people and people who do press work, you know.
You mean why aren't the Democrats or why aren't the people?
Republicans or
anybody. Why doesn't anybody care? Our politics is pretty debased right now. Obviously, I don't have an answer to that.
Well, just think about it. You'll come up with one in 2 weeks.
Yeah. 2 weeks.
Okay. That's another challenge for you. You met the last one. Now go for this one. Thank you for your work.
Yes, hi. For someone who is kind of tuned into photojournalism and often shuts their eyes when watching the TV news, it's nice to see somebody actually from radio, you know, gesticulating and actually expressing themselves with their hands.
Okay. Sometimes I know that they're not. I have anecdotal research based on things said on Twitter that suggests that at least half of the listening public thinks I'm a black lesbian, and when they see me, yeah, the intense disappointment I can read all over their face.
So. Yeah. I'm reassured by your hands, you know, they tell stories. Well, the question I'd like to ask is, I'd like you to think a little bit with me about the sort of the arc that happened with the whole idea of advertising, the art of persuasion, tying into envy and greed and so forth, how that might have arced over to the type of television imagery that came unto The Apprentice and all of that. The image of being that there are certain Trump voters who are really in dire straits, you know, I mean, opioid, you know, addictions and unemployment and so forth. And then the image that gets thrown at you sometimes is this sort of gilded cage in Mar-a-Lago. I mean, and that seems to be what, a success or an envy thing or what? I mean, is that really a dominant image that wants to be, and the Trump Tower and all that? How does that speak to you in terms of where his voters really want to be, as if it's an empowering thing?
It was never meant to speak to me. I think it wasn't intended to. I think that, and I'll give an answer, and then Margaret may want to jump in here, but I mean, my view is that he basically said, you know, the system is rigged because for decades, no one's paid any attention to you, and now you're worried about your kids. which of course isn't just an angry white middle. I mean, that's been going on for literally centuries all over the country among other communities, immigrant communities, certainly communities of color, all of that. The thing is that these guys who were angry and felt neglected were neglected in the middle of the country vote. So there you go. So basically Trump said to them, I believe, look at me, I'm a big success. And as I've told you during the debates, I greased politicians. Mm-hmm. I lied and I didn't pay my taxes, mm-hmm. which was smart. Mm-hmm. I know the system is rigged, mm-hmm. and you do too, and I will rig it for you.
And a lot of the carpenters that were involved in his failures, basically,
wage theft, all of that. They didn't communicate. They were listening to him directly over the heads of the media. And that's frankly, the media waited way too long to report on mm-hmm. that stuff. Mm-hmm. They were joking about him, and they were dissing him, and they didn't start really in-depth and continuous, persistent investigation until after the nomination. And so that, I haven't seen any data on that, but what do you think?
I appreciate that, but there's so many images also, eminent domain. I'm the champion of eminent domain. There's a little house that's in the way of my casino. It's got to go. You know what I mean? Those were some incredible photojournalism images that I would have.
Yeah, but you were more attuned to those than other people were.
Thank you very much.
Do you, Margaret?
Thank
you. I think that those images were less important than the fact that Trump seemed to be talking about jobs, and that you can parse this election 1,000 different ways, all the things that went right or wrong for different people. But I think that he seemed to be talking about people's economic well-being, and Clinton didn't do as much of that. So I don't think it's so much about what. The golden elevators at Trump Tower or anything like that. That's mm-hmm. my sense of it. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You talk about this as a time of moral panic, and so I have a moral question where I'd like a little moral guidance on something. I have noticed in myself and in people that I speak with this understanding that Donald Trump is so impervious to what we think of as sort of the larger scale objective reality that it would require something really, really big, really clearly bad, like a stock market crash, genuine crash, or North Korea actually exploding a nuclear weapon over somebody's head, to puncture that little bubble and to convince the president, or at least the people around him, that he's really not doing things right. The problem is that, obviously, that involves an enormous amount of suffering for an enormous number of people. And it also plays into the hands of people who say, you just want to see him fail. You just want to see him fail. No, you want to see reality, and you think maybe his failure has to be dramatic enough to make reality impinge. But that hurts a lot of people along the way. What do you propose, if you have a proposal, what do you propose we do about that?
Margaret? Can I have 2 weeks? I'll get back to you.
Absolutely. You can do that after the other book. Number three.
Hi there. Really big fan of yours. I ask about the long-term view. I'm a librarian myself, so I'm aware, I call myself personal verified information. So I know you mentioned beforehand that information goes in and out. There's waves of information. And I know that journalists write the first draft of history. Do you talk to other librarians, other archivists, to say what is going on in the future, how this information will be saved? Because as much as we can say that Trump is unpopular, he's only at 38%, it's majority of people believe in a different kind of reality. I mean, even if he were to somehow become an authoritarian and take control of large, even the Soviet Union had dissidents. Even the Soviet Union, there were all different kinds of authoritarian states that actually had a large number of secret reading rooms. So information cannot be fully controlled no matter how well you do it. So I'd ask, what are you planning on doing for the long term? You talk about how things will actually change. Not saying you cannot have to, but I'm saying in your show itself.
Well, it's an interesting thing because people are concerned about the fact that information is being taken off of websites at great rates, and there are organizations that are trying to migrate some of that database to Canada and elsewhere so that we can get back to it. It's kind of like in the Middle Ages, the monks with the repositories of information that was no longer allowed. Hopefully we aren't entering into another Dark Ages. And by the way, librarians totally rule. And but yeah, no, I mean, as someone who focuses on the freedom of information an awful lot, in my job, this concerns me enormously, and I do think that it's not hard to gather and preserve that stuff, at least over the short term. Over the long term, there's constant shifting of the modes of storage, and can one machine read another? But I'm not talking about 100 years or even 10 years. I'm talking about a few years, and I do think it's very important to preserve that stuff. But I personally, aside from reporting on it, I can't do anything about it. Hi.
Hi.
We have about 4 more minutes for questions, just so you know.
Okay.
What? One more? Okay.
So my question is, I really appreciate it when you said, and I try to remember this myself, don't listen to everything that is said every day about, like, you know, what did you do today kind of thing, and don't pay attention to the details because you'll have a meltdown. Focus. Well, what do I focus on? What to
Well, that's your, no, that is, you know what to focus on.
No, well,
you know what you find the issue or issues that you really care about, and then
and what?
They're like what?
Yeah. I mean, I have
there's
no so,
you know, the environment, women's rights, racism, and hate
really
speech, the preservation of health care. I mean, these things. There are people organizing to address practically every issue you can talk about. I mean, I know that, you know, right after Trump was elected, we were doing a thing on the endless numbers of small-scale demonstrations. And in New York on one day, there were, you know, like 50 of them. And they don't have impact. Unless they're really big and they're sustained, they don't. But I remember that, you know, among it was like anti-fur. Not that I have a strong position on fur, but I mean, it just seemed like not the thing that I would have focused on at that time.
But my concern though, is that even if, you know, there's 100 people who are support, you know, want to support Planned Parenthood or supporting the environment or immigration, I don't have a sense that it is going to make a difference.
It will over the long haul on the local level. Now, you know, if you live in D.C. or if your congressperson isn't, you know, you might have to.
We don't have one.
I know. I lived here for 13 years. You know, there were a few things that felt like, you know, I once tried to write a novel about the future, and it was the year 2500, and they were. And there was the Washington Post was having a meeting, and one guy goes, I think D.C. statehood's really going to happen this year. But, so I know, but I mean, there are things, it's not my area, but there are things that can really make it, I mean, it's just a small difference. Signing people up to, you know, register outside of the, you know.
It's hard to feel optimistic that those things
it's very hard.
Will make a difference.
It's nothing, look. Think about, I don't know if you're a reporter, I don't know who you are, but all I can say is that you spend your whole life being irrelevant and not making a difference. And so so you just, something keeps you going anyway.
Okay, thanks.
And that's it. Thank you.
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.